Welcome, everyone, to episode number 54 of Underserved. Today, we are featuring Steve Picciano, VP of Engineering at Fine-Tune. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Steve, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming down today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So tell me a bit about, what was the initial impetus? What kind of sparked your interest in technology way back when?
Oh, that was easy. Back when I was in middle school, when really there weren't computers in most people's homes or even too many electronics, we were fortunate to have one of the early Atari computers, the one that had a keyboard on it. You could play games with it. That was pretty much it. And really just started playing around with that. And I would sign up to get some magazines, which had code. And I would type code into these little cassette cartridges and realize that it would compile and make a game. And the games back then were very crude, but I just found that to be completely fascinating. And then we also had a VCR, one of the first to have a VHS VCR. And that was back when you had to choose kind of between VHS and beta. We went with the VHS. And one of the first things I did was I took it apart to see what was inside, how it worked. I was just fascinated by that.
Well, VHS won the format war, oh, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably not your last format war of your career.
That's true.
So did you do any programming in high school?
They did, yeah. They offered a few computer science classes, and they were the old style punch card kind of classes where you would first program something and then you'd produce a bunch of punch cards with it. And then that was essentially your format for keeping your software. And then quickly after that, as you know, floppy disks were around and really just built on that when I went to college, really wanted to focus on computer engineering.
Now, was it difficult to concentrate on that at Michigan State?
A little bit, yeah. I actually played football there, so that was my full-time job. When you play Big Ten football, that's an all-day thing and year-round, I found out. But I did really enjoy it, and it's a beautiful campus, one of the most beautiful campuses I've been to as well. And of course, had a lot of great friends. And with 45,000 students, there was always something to do around campus.
So you, I assume, take some more computer science in college and then graduate?
Right, for sure. Yeah, I focused more on computer engineering, which was embedded computer systems, a lot of assembly language coding, C, Fortran, Pascal, but really focused a lot on the hardware too. I was really interested in embedded systems and control systems and how the software made the hardware work and so forth. And so that was really the area I focused on, especially around communication systems. And that was my first internship as well as my first job out of college, was that really more of embedded software.
And what were you building there?
So my first internship, we actually built these little communication boxes, which would hook up to a digital typewriter, but it was really more of a point of sale machine. This was before fully computerized cash registers were around. And then my first job, full-time job, was at CNR, and that was a communication system that was used to communicate with three different formats. So we could receive signals via satellite, RF, or landline. And this was a project that was being done for FEMA, that so our devices could be used if a natural disaster occurred or something worse that wasn't natural. And we'd be prepared, our country would be prepared. So that was kind of cool. It was very cutting edge.
Is that like some sort of DARPA offshoot?
It was, yeah, for sure. And it was used actually in 1992. They rolled it out when Hurricane Andrew hit Florida. And they brought these, I guess they're like large RVs that held these communication devices. And since there was no power and no landlines available, the residents in Florida were wondering how these people were able to communicate with these devices. And it turns out there were ships off the coast that were feeding signals to these devices as well as satellite at the time.
Well, then the secret was out.
The secret was out then, yeah. So that was no longer a dark project after that.
And then where did you move on to after that?
So then I went to EASL, and that was when I really sort of took a turn from embedded software and got into application software. And I really found that I enjoyed business software and understanding the business and the solution I really enjoyed getting to know users and our customers and what they were doing with the software that we were building, and found that I had more to me than just programming and technology, but understanding how it was used. And really, that was my jumpstart of my career. And I've been doing that ever since. And really, to this day, really enjoy having empathy for our users and our customers and knowing how they're using our product.
So is ESL where you were first exposed to Smalltalk?
It was, yeah. I first started with their sort of older tool, which was a proprietary 4GL language called ESL, ESL Workbench. That was used to really modernize business applications, could connect to a variety of backends, databases and other systems like AS400s and so forth. It used Halopi for screen scraping, where you could just read, take these antiquated systems and turn them into graphical user interfaces. And it was quite popular. It struggled a bit toward the end when I joined there because Power Builder and Microsoft had now come out with their own offering with Visual Basic. So ESL was kind of falling by the wayside. They had another product called Enfin Studio, which was Smalltalk. And I quickly moved into Smalltalk and object-oriented development and really enjoyed that a lot. I loved the concepts around OOAD and object-oriented programming. And so most of the company had shifted toward Enfin because that was the future. ESL ended up being sold. They were a publicly traded company. They were bought by VMark, which I believe was based out in Framingham. And VMark was a database company, and they bought ESL. I don't want to say it was kind of a fire sale, I think, but they were buying it really for the ESL Workbench tool, and they wanted to use that with their database so people who bought their database could build front ends fairly quickly.
And then I think you had a story about VMark after the acquisition trying to share the vision with the team.
That's right, yeah. So along those lines, after the VMark acquisition occurred, I was actually working down in Baltimore on a project. I was in the consulting group. We were doing an Enfin implementation down there. Smalltalk implementation. And I called into the meeting where the executives from VMark visited the ESL office up in Burlington, Massachusetts. And it was an all hands meeting where they were going to talk about the acquisition and answer questions. They were going to talk about their vision for ESL, the products and the services and so forth. And it was funny, someone asked about Enfin and said, well, you keep talking about ESL, Workbench, and how it's going to integrate with the VMark database. What's the story with Enfin? And their VP of technology said, well, we think object-oriented development is a passing fad, at which point there was complete silence in the room. I was on the phone and you could hear the tension. I think within the next couple of weeks, maybe a quarter or a third of the company resigned after that. So that was a good way to get people out the door, I suppose.
Yeah, Smalltalk tends to be polarizing. Like, there are its adherents that are like, this is one of the most pure object-oriented languages you will ever use. And then there's other people that are like, it's just so arcane and I just don't get it.
Yeah, it was pure. There's a lot of different levels of object-orientedness, you know, and C++ was, I guess, the real competitor there. Ada kind of played in that space at the time. Java didn't really exist yet. It was about to. It was like alpha 0.7, 0.8, I guess, at the time. And the thing about Smalltalk was it already started to build the ecosystem. One of the challenges with Smalltalk was there's too many different distributions of it with Digitalk and Park, and IBM had Visual Age that came out, and then Enfin existed. And they weren't quite the same, so it created its own little divisiveness, I guess, in that space. But the principles around object-oriented analysis and design, those carried on, and I think people started to embrace those. A lot of companies started to embrace those. Being a Smalltalk expert, we kind of looked down on Java when it came out, and we looked down on C++. And you're right, it was very polarizing for sure. Yeah.
The ivory tower Smalltalk guys.
That's right. That's right.
So you see the writing on the wall at ESL. I think you move on to consulting after that.
Yeah, I got together with a couple of guys that I had worked on a project with, and we started a consulting company, Intrepid Consulting. It was primarily Smalltalk. I guess, believe it or not, one of the first sort of assets we provided was Smalltalk conversion toolkits. So being able to convert from Enfin or Digitalk to Visual Age. And we saw Visual Age as, if Smalltalk survives, it's going to be IBM that's going to make it happen. So we partnered with IBM and we got some good business through them, some really good projects. worked on some very interesting projects too at the time. One was out in Indianapolis for a company called Master Software, and they were using Enfin to build, it was really a tracking software for managing donors for something that a lot of universities would buy their software, but also a lot of nonprofits would buy their software, and they would track donations and donors. This was right around the time Windows 95 came out. So a lot of companies like Master Software had the old Windows 3.1 character mode applications. So they really wanted to jump to Windows 95 and the graphical interface. This was their only product. So the company was kind of banking their future on Enfin and Smalltalk to get them there. And it was a challenging project, really challenging. It was one of those ones where I'd show up at 6 a.m. in the morning and I'd be there till 9 o'clock at night, 4 days a week. And then Fridays, fly home late morning back to Boston. So
you were at Indy 4 days a week?
Yeah. Yep.
Were you there around the end of May for the race?
I was. I was actually there 13 months. I was there a long time. I did go to the Indy 500 and I went to the Brickyard, which was a lot of fun. So I'm a big race fan.
Nice.
That was enjoyable getting to see a race there.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, you also got to dabble in a very young Java at the time as well.
I did, yeah. I was asked, because my name had kind of gotten out there as a Smalltalk expert, I was asked to help beta test as they got to Java 0.8, I think it was, help beta test Java. And I did. I enjoyed doing that. And I found all the deficiencies, just like I should, being a Smalltalk expert. It was really immature at the time, and actually a lot of Fortune 500 IT companies really were not embracing Java either. It was still thought of as this play language that the kids are going to play around with, but no one's going to ever build anything enterprise class or enterprise quality with Java. And you know, you looked at Smalltalk, and we already had a persistence layer, and we had a layer for an MVC architecture. You know, we had a lot of things that Java didn't have yet. It was just sort of a base language, and honestly didn't take it very seriously. But I said to my partner at Intrepid, like, hey, we should build out a Java practice because this could turn into something. We ended up selling the company before that happened, but we were in the process of building out a Java practice too.
It looks like you'd spent some time detouring into security after that.
Yeah, then I joined Hewlett Packard. Part of that was to get off the road. I'd been traveling for years with Easel and Intrepid. I was a little bit weary from the road. And so Hewlett Packard was looking to move into Java as well and start building some application software to help manage the servers. And I joined a group up in Chelmsford, which was one of their remote labs. It was their internet security lab. And so that was a lot of fun, actually, at first. Got to learn a lot about internet security from a corporate point of view, and that was cool. And started to lay out a plan to start moving some of their applications to Java to re-implement from languages like TCL or TCL to Java. And that was all well and good for a few months until HP decided they weren't quite sure what they were going to do with our lab because they had this tendency to have groups overlapping in different locations. And so they told us, hey, we're going to find basically a new business plan for the lab in Chelmsford. We want all the talent to hang out, want you to stay. We don't want you to leave. The good news, this was right around April timeframe, I think it was, just when summer was approaching. So I decided I was going to work on my golf game and get in shape. And so we had plenty of time for that now because there was really no work to be had in the lab. So I did. I started taking golf seriously. My scores from upper 90s to low 80s. Yeah, with a lot of practice. So
you were paid to golf at like Stowe Acres and Butternut?
Yeah, we hit them all. Yep. We'd head up to New Hampshire, drive up there. But I was playing about four rounds a week. And then what I also found, this is the engineer in me. I always try to look at the little details of how can I get a little bit better or do things better. And would go to the driving range before playing around, and that made a big difference. You know, you get your swing down, you can practice on a small bucket of balls first. That helps a lot. The other thing I found too was once I didn't keep score, I actually just kept score of my strokes. So Was it a tee shot? Was it a bunker shot? You know, was it a putt? And realized I was giving up a lot of strokes on the green. And that's where I really started to focus more attention. So
the old short game.
Yeah. So, you know, I could go out there all the time and blast one 270, 280 off the tee and hit it straight. But then after that, everything fell apart. So I started working on the short stuff.
So you were your own primitive version of golf shot analytics.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
And I would argue you were a pro golfer if you were being paid to golf 4 days a week.
Right.
All right. So something that fun can't last forever. You end up becoming an Oracle practice manager after that.
Yeah, exactly. So I joined Oracle, got back into consulting, really wanted to get back in front of customers. And again, I love to solve different problems. And one thing with consulting is when you work on projects that are 6 to 12 months, you know, your job is basically changing every few months, which is great. So I went to Oracle Consulting and they said, trying to find an opportunity to, again, work with Java. They were just about to embrace Java. They had a few small pockets in their organization where they were working with Java, but mostly it was PLSQL. And I said, well, I really don't want to learn PLSQL. I have no desire to. But then they sold me on this group. It was a data warehousing practice. And I looked at a bunch of the tools that they had and the solutions around building out a data warehouse solution and data analytics and decision support systems, and actually just really fell in love with that, fell in love with data and what you could learn from data. And I said, if I have to figure out PLSQL, I'll do it. And I did. It's just a tool of the trade. And then I started working with some of the tools they had acquired specifically around data marts and data warehouse and so forth. So I worked on several projects, mostly here in the Northeast for a variety of companies building out financial data marts and data warehouses.
But it's the late 90s. Like, you got to spend some time at an internet startup of some sort.
You do, yeah. I mean, I enjoyed my time at Oracle, and I really enjoyed the people I worked with there. But, you know, everyone was jumping to a .com, and companies were changing their name to put .com on the end of it. And, you know, you saw the bubble growing, and I really got the itch to do a startup again. And, you know, my time at Oracle was actually probably one of the best times at Oracle. In the 2 years I worked there, their stock price doubled and split twice in 2 years. So they were doing great too. They were definitely in that space. But yeah, I got together with a couple of the guys that I had joined at Intrepid Consulting, and they had an idea for a .com, and they had already raised some angel funding. So we'd love to have you come aboard. It's warranties on the web. And I didn't know a lot about that, but it kind of made sense to me that a lot of people don't know that when you walk into Sears or Home Depot or wherever and you buy a product, you frequently are asked if you want to buy a warranty with it. What they don't know is you can buy a warranty for that product anywhere from anyone. And there's a bunch of warranty providers out there. Nowadays, I think people know that. Back in 1999, nobody knew that. And so I thought, well, this is great. E-commerce and the internet is just becoming a big thing now. And after you buy a product, we can send you an offer for a warranty and even multiple vendors. So we can even create a bidding situation where we could get two or three vendors bidding on maybe the warranty for the camera you just bought or the new microphone that you just bought. So I thought there was a real market there and really wanted to pursue that. After I joined, I then learned quickly that warranties are actually somewhat regulated, and they're regulated by the state. And so if we were to sell to you in, say, Massachusetts, that was different than selling to someone in maybe Iowa or Florida. The rules are different. The laws are different. So that was something we weren't quite prepared for. And so we looked at maybe a shift in our business model to something else.
I think you did do some kind of upsell, cross-sell work while you were there.
Right. Yeah. We took that idea around really trying to monetize, again, users' information. So instead of doing warranties on the web, we still were in that e-commerce chain, but we were looking at advertising. And at the time, there was a few companies. CMGI was one of the big ones. They had a whole breadth of companies underneath them that were focusing on advertising and marketing to individuals. At the time, browser technology was not what it is like today. There was some clickstream data, but it wasn't that valuable. You could use cookies, but they were still pretty basic tracking cookies. So what we decided was, why don't we just get people to tell us what they want? What would you be interested in seeing an advertisement for? And if you clicked on it, you bought something, that would be worth it to us, and it would be worth it to you, and it'd be worth it to the company you bought it from. And then try to use some of that to help upsell again. So if you bought a camera, we'd follow up with an ad for a camera bag or a camera stand, for example. Or a computer, if you bought a computer from Dell, we'd follow up with an ad for a printer, perhaps. And one of the things that we learned was that we wanted to start creating this community where we could reward people. And we found that people were interested in that. They wanted to be rewarded for their data, rewarded for their activity online. And that's essentially the model we created. So it was kind of a rewards model where you could shop, and we had some ideas about what to do with those rewards. I wanted to go down the path of like, hey, we'd buy you lottery tickets or something. But I think that was viewed as gambling at the time, so we couldn't do that. But
that's too bad.
Yeah.
I would love to get some lottery tickets for all of my Amazon spending.
That's right. That's right. Most people would.
Thank you so much for joining this Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? You see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute.
Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
Yeah, I remember wanted to push some sort of upsell, cross-sell engine at the time. We were doing some consulting for a company in the area, and that was kind of their crown jewel. Like, yeah, we'll help you do fulfillment and payment and whatever. But then, like, while they're still in the cart, we're going to help sell them more stuff.
Right, right. Back in 1999 to 2000, it's really was very immature, not like it is today. You know, it really was about another 5 years before some of the bigger companies started to figure it out and figure out how to really target consumers and how to offer them the right things that they were interested in. And even that rewards model, you know, the cash back and so forth, we didn't start to see that until 2005, 2006 timeframe. So I think we were a little bit ahead of our time. And then we had the bubble bursting at that time. So I remember just almost every day presenting to another VC, showing demos and proof of concepts that we had built. And they're holding their checkbook really tight with their hand. They weren't offering the investments like they were in 97 and 98. So we were, I think, a couple years late on the idea. And then the idea itself was a little bit early for some people to really understand.
So you come in out of the cold to a bigger company, 170 Systems?
Yeah, they were still a startup. They had been around, though, for a little while, I think close to 10 years at that point. And yeah, they were about 100 people at the time I joined there. And I used my Oracle background. They were supporting or integrating with Oracle ERP. And everything was running in the Oracle database. And they were image enabling some processes like accounts payable and expense management. And one of the reasons I joined there was using my consulting background, because the company had kind of been a consulting company that had a whole bunch of assets, reusable assets, very similar to what I started to do back at Intrepid and Easel. You know, you show up at a customer site with your bag of tricks and your bag of reusable code, and that's what they had too. And they wanted to hire me to really build out a true product group to help turn some of that reusable assets and that reusable code into more of a product. And so I looked at that as a real challenge. So we started with some of the engineers from their consulting group, and we turned them into product engineers. We hired QA people, hired a tech writer, hired a bunch more product engineers who, you know, knew how to build sustainable code. And we built out the team and started with a very small team and kept building it out and created product roadmaps and hired a product manager as well into the group. So really turned it into a product company.
So many consulting groups want to be able to take what they do, especially the repeatable parts, like you said, and turn it into a SKU.
Right.
You know, something
right.
that you could sell as a
Anything
product.
You can charge licensing for and ideally get annual support revenues from and so forth. They say, you know, with consulting companies, you're only as good as your people. That's really all you have is your people. So, yeah, so most consulting companies are really trying to find how to increase revenues through licensing.
So how did it work in this case?
By the time we got to about 2004, 2005, our target was to cross the 50% line, where 50% of our revenue was from licensing and the other 50% was still consulting. There's still a lot of customizations, especially when you talk about an Oracle ERP. Later, we supported SAP and PeopleSoft too. There really is no out-of-the-box ERP system. So there had to be a little bit of consulting, in some cases, a lot of consulting with it. But we started with a product that we could charge for. So I think it was about 4 or 5 years that we had crossed the 50% mark. And I think by the time we sold the company in 2009, it was just over 50% revenue in licensing.
So you start interviewing and you had a good interview story when you spoke to the folks at MITRE.
I did. So MITRE was right down the street from me. And, you know, I had a recruiter had actually put me in touch with someone at MITRE and said, hey, they've got this position. It's in their IT group, business applications. Lots of different technologies. I think this would be right up your alley, given your background with data and data warehousing and ERP integrations and Smalltalk and Java and Visual Basic. It's a little bit of everything. You might want to check this out. So I went through the interview process there, which was quite lengthy. And when after I had gone through the process, I decided, I don't think this is for me. I'm a startup guy. I like things fast-paced. You know, working for a government-funded organization is not what I'm really envisioned for my next step. And one of the things that a senior director who I met with said to me was, one of the reasons that you don't want to come here is one of the reasons we want you here, and we want you to change that. And, you know, I explained to him that there's not much here that's a technical challenge for me. By this point, you know, I had successfully implemented Agile at a few organizations, including 170 Systems. So I said, that's not really that big of a challenge. And some of the things that go along with Agile, like DevOps and automated testing and continuous integration and deployment, had already been kind of working with those things. So that wasn't new to me by any means. But the thing that really struck me was that he said to me too is, some of that stuff is pretty easy. Changing a culture is really hard. And that's what I kind of took to heart. And I said, you know what? I think he's right. You know, I haven't gone into a situation where I've had to change a culture. I've helped create culture with startups and whatnot, but not changing a culture to turn them more fast-paced and turn them into an organization that follows a new development process. And it was challenging. It was rocky at times. And there were times where people still wanted to fall back to the old way of doing things. And it was a great 3 years, actually. I met some great people there, and I really enjoyed working there.
Very nice. So some of your friends from 170 move on to another company, Hadapt?
They did, yeah. I knew a few guys from 170. We circled back again. And I guess this is a lesson, you know, is people that you see in your career, you're going to see them again at some point. So yeah, they joined Hadapt. And I didn't know too much about it, but they said, hey, we'd love to have you come aboard. We just hired a VP of engineering, but we really need some more leadership at the company. Really need to get this product to be more stable, to install easier, to be easier to support with our customers. And we need to grow the number of customers we have. And when I sat down with the CEO of the company, who's a good friend of mine, and I met with the managing partner of the venture company that was funding Hadapt, he said, you know, we're going to try to sell the company within a couple of years. So he wasn't saying this is not a long-term thing, but need you to come in and do this and help us get this to a point where we have more customers, more revenue, we can stabilize the product and make it look good. So
how quickly did they end up selling the company?
It was actually close to 2 years, about 18 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was pretty close. We did. We got to a point where we had a pretty good product and we had a few more customers. There was a lot of competition in that space, in the SQL execution space at that time. A lot of money going into Hortonworks and Cloudera, the Hadoop offerings. And we worked with Hadoop, worked on a Hadoop cluster, but a lot of competition coming from people with very deep pockets. So I think they sold the company at the right time.
So you become part of Teradata?
We did. So Teradata bought us. They decided that they didn't really have much interest in the Hadapt commercial product that we built, but they were interested in our knowledge and experience with Hadoop. They did have a small group at Teradata that was building a Hadoop appliance that they shipped. And the idea is they're like Hadoop was really a competitor to Teradata. It was taking away business much cheaper than a Teradata cluster. So as Teradata is trying to upsell and cross-sell into other parts of a company, mostly Fortune 500 companies, their response they're getting back is, well, we want to try this Hadoop thing first and see what that can do with our data. And so they kind of fell in line with that. Well, oh, we're also Hadoop. So we've got Hadoop too. They bought us for that experience and they formed the Center for Hadoop. And we were part of that. They decided that they didn't really want the execution engine that we had, but we had worked with them to partner with Facebook to develop Presto. And so Presto was an open source execution engine that Teradata could distribute. And we would distribute that on their Hadoop cluster, although we could support other Hadoop clusters. And the idea there is that we would be this alternative that if a customer said, no, we don't want any more Teradata software, we want this Presto or Hadoop software, they had an offering for that. We also built connectors to start connecting data from other sources and pull that into a central location, in this case, Hadoop. And so we started building connectors to Teradata and from Teradata as well, so we could move data back and forth. And so that's really what the focus of our group was.
So then you have another interesting all-hands meeting where they're going to talk about the vision for the product.
Yeah, so it's almost 20 years. I don't know if it's to the day, but it was pretty close from the Easel acquisition. Teradata comes out to our office in Cambridge, right in Central Square. We have a really small office out there. And they sent some executives out from Teradata and the engineering executive. A few of the folks asked about the Hadap software. And they said, well, we don't really see much of a vision for that. But, you know, we know that there's other things you can do in that area of Hadoop. The acquisition was for, again, the minds and the talent again. And so someone asked, you know, what does that mean exactly if we're not going to be working on Hadapt? And so the analogy that he gave or the story he told was this executive was that, well, when he goes to the grocery store to buy food for dinner, he doesn't really know what he's going to make yet, but he walks around the produce section and he starts looking at the vegetables and he picks up the best vegetables, whatever looks the best, he'll buy. And then when he gets home, he looks at what he has, what were the best vegetables that day, and then figure out what to make from there. And so one of our more junior developers kind of raised his hand and said, does that mean we're the vegetables? And there was a moment of silence at that point too. And I think there's a few people that were, you know, I've been through a few acquisitions and there's always this point where they're either going to wow you or they're not. And I think some of the ones I've been through, they've really dropped the ball. And I would say that's another one where I don't think that the people who were in that room were all in after that. You know, it just was kind of a bizarre statement.
So you decide you don't want to be part of the ratatouille.
Yeah.
So some of your ESL friends are at Cloud Health at the time.
Yeah. So I stayed at Teradata for 3 years and we did a fantastic job with Presto. We actually had several paying customers and we were generating some recurring revenue. Subscription licenses was something that Teradata hadn't really done before. This was really also their first open source offering that they had done. And so that was all real positive. And we had this small office in Seaport area in Boston. They decided that they were going to start to, as Teradata's fortune started to decline, they decided they were going to close a few offices. I think they ended up closing 5 offices. And one of them was ours. Most of us were offered relocation packages out to San Diego, which would have been a lot of fun. I enjoyed going out there and I really enjoyed the people I worked with out there in San Diego. And if I was a little closer to retirement and I didn't have kids in high school here, I might have thought about it, but decided otherwise. And After that, I actually took a few months off and tried to start my own company. I looked at something in the ed tech space around coming up with a better way, almost like the way maybe some MBA teams start scouting high schoolers or even middle schoolers nowadays. It was something very similar to that, where companies could start scouting high schoolers and help them get through the college admissions process, offer them internships while they're in college, and then streamlining the process such that colleges also didn't have to worry about a certain number of positions, I guess, in their college. They would hand those off to, you know, a bigger tech company that would be doing that, and built out a prototype that I think was showed well and people really got it. They understood it. I just couldn't figure out how to make money at it. So trying to put a price on it for somebody to pay, I couldn't scale it out enough to make a living doing it. So I decided to go to Cloud Health after that. I knew one of the founders from my days at Easel. I also knew a couple other folks at the company too, and they were on a rocket ship at the time looking to double revenues and double their engineering staff, and they planned to IPO within 2 to 3 years and wanted to be part of that experience and learn a lot more about the cloud, which was absolutely amazing. And about 8 months after I joined, they decided to sell to VMware. So that didn't last too long.
So what do you do after that?
Well, I stayed through the acquisition at VMware. That was interesting. VMware is a great company, but realized that I really wanted to get back to a startup and stayed about a year and a half with VMware after the acquisition, and then joined Fine-Tune, which was in the ed tech space. That was really the thing that attracted me about Fine-Tune. And they have a variety of products right now. One of the ones that I work with is one of the bigger ones, which is for the AP classes and pre-AP classes, to helping with online learning and remote learning to prepare for AP exams and prepare for the pre-AP exams.
So if I'm an in-person student, I might also use this, or is it instead of having an AP teacher?
You can, yeah. It's different options. So most of the students who are in schools will use this. They'll use it in their class. They'll use it when they go home. There are some districts where they may not have a teacher available who's certified for, let's say, AP Physics, at some of the more rural districts that are out there. So they could sign up and take the coursework through the application, sort of self-learning without a teacher there necessarily. Again, it's to prepare them. So we prescribe a certain way of learning for individuals, and based on how they do at various progress checks, they get fed another set of instructional material.
So you joined right in March of 2020.
I did. Timing was impeccable.
I imagine things changed pretty quickly over the next few months.
Yeah, things were shutting down by the day. I remember I had to drive down to Virginia Tech and pick up my son because his school just closed. So I had to go get all of his stuff from his dorm room and get him and bring him home. And then started just after that. And yeah, it didn't impact the company's culture as much because they were already 100% remote. They have engineers in 14 different countries, spanning 5 continents, I believe, actually. And, you know, we had all the tools in place already. So it wasn't like most tech companies where I've worked, like Cloud Health. Some people work remote certain days, but most people are in the office. So you just have to make sure you get your WebEx set up or whatever for them to join. It wasn't quite like that. So people already had the culture of being remote, using Slack, using tools like Zoom to communicate. So that wasn't a big shift, but schools going remote was a big shift. Suddenly our platform got used a lot more, and we really had to watch for availability and performance and making sure our uptime was hitting the SLAs. So that was something that shifted quickly on us, because that was also right before schools would be having exams. So you went into March and April, and a lot of those exams are going to start happening in May and June. So that was right during our peak period as well.
What's the tech stack you guys are using?
I'll say nothing too cutting edge, but it's all in Amazon on the cloud. We use a lot of different Amazon services, React on the front end, Python on the back end. I've got some relational and some non-relational database stuff going on. My passion is obviously data engineering, so we're spending some time looking at migrating our backend data architecture to something a little more modern there. But, you know, it's something that scales pretty well. And, you know, I think generally our users, which are the teachers in the United States and the students, really enjoy using our platform. So
what relational database are you guys using these days?
So it's mostly MySQL, which, you know, it's not Oracle, but I don't think we need Oracle.
It's owned by Oracle, right?
Yeah. I think Oracle owns everything. They own Java now. But yeah, we're doing a little bit with Redshift Spectrum. We've got some Elasticsearch back there and Neo4j, MongoDB, kind of a little bit of Postgres in there. So a lot of it was, you know, we used the right tool for the feature that we're trying to solve for. I think the future vision is going to be more of the data sitting on sparse flat files on S3 and try to leverage execution engines. Maybe Presto might make a comeback there. We're looking at some options around that. Redshift Spectrum, we still like. And then doing more with Elastic as well, Elasticsearch.
So that's the tech side for managing a distributed team in 14 different countries and God knows how many time zones. Do you have any tips or tricks you would impart to fellow software development managers?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the thing I really learned was you not only have to be good at communicating, you have to over-communicate and you have to communicate in different forms. So if you try to communicate something at, let's say, an Agile stand-up, you also have to put it in Slack. And if you send something in email, you also have to put it in Slack. Can't count on people hearing you at the time you say it. You can't count on people reading an email or even being in the right Slack channel. So you need to make sure that you communicate it around to a lot of different Slack channels. Like, I'll give you an example of that. When we are getting ready to do a release, we have this little automated script that posts, I think, to 6 different Slack channels that we're about to release. Because we're trying to make sure that everybody has eyes on it and they know what's happening.
When in doubt, spam it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So, Steve, thank you very much for coming down and sharing your stories with the listeners of Underserved.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.